Welcome to episode 10 of the podcast. In this episode, we have an instructional segment where I go over the ways to optimize your conditioning program for racquetball, and also a conversation with John Ellis, a great former player, coach, and now administrator out of Stockton, California. Please enjoy episode 10 of the Racquetball Show podcast.
I will be the greatest player to ever play the game.
Anybody who won't dive for it
shouldn't be playing.
Get that ball. Get the ball.
So for this episode of the Racquetball Show, for the instructional segment, I'm going to be getting into conditioning and how to optimally condition your body for a racquetball match or a tournament. And the first thing I want to get into, and I've gotten into this a little bit before on the show, is the number one most important thing, I think, is that doing something is better than doing nothing. So while I'm going to get into what I think is the optimal way to work out for racquetball, the optimal way to condition your body, if you aren't already really working hard on your conditioning, starting small and starting with something is going to be better than going for what I'm going to say is optimal and then trying it for 2 weeks and failing at it and quitting and doing nothing. So make it fun for yourself. Make it something that you're going to enjoy, and then work your way into, if you want, into doing something that's more intense and strictly focused on how can I optimally condition my body for racquetball. With that being said, what do I think is the optimal way to condition your body for a racquetball match? There are a couple things I'd like to say on this subject. One, I think that optimally, people consider conditioning a lot of the time to be long, slow, boring cardio. You know, people think of like a marathon runner as being in the best shape cardio-wise, so that's what they try to mimic in order to develop their cardio for racquetball. And I, from an optimal health standpoint, I disagree with that. I think so for racquetball, the energy system you want to develop, you want to mimic a racquetball game. You want to be doing essentially, you know, a racquetball game is short, intense bursts of energy followed by a bit of rest. You know, you'll maybe have a hardcore 10-second rally followed by maybe 20 seconds of rest. And that pattern is repeated, obviously, I don't know, 100 times throughout the course of a match. So you want to do what's going to mimic that to get your body ready to handle that load during a match. Another thing that I think is important is that you can't just think of conditioning as cardio training. I found that while I would, in matches where I felt like I was getting super tired, it wasn't necessarily the case that I was super tired because I was cardiovascularly burnt out in that sense. It was more that my legs would be exhausted, and because my legs were so tired, you know, they just didn't have the strength that they did at the beginning of that match or at the beginning of that tournament. I would then get cardiovascularly tired due to the fact that my legs had fatigued. So you want to build up and work on the thing that is kind of your limiting factor. So in that case, it was my legs, and I think that's the case with most people. Your legs are going to be the first thing to go, and then your cardio goes because of that. So build up that leg strength. Build up that that ability to basically take intense lunges and quick movements a bunch of times throughout a match. Now, how can you do this? What are some specific exercises? What I would recommend is in your workouts, do take on a steady diet of a bunch of high repetition, low volume leg strengthening exercises. So for me, that would be things like lunges, squats, deadlifts, Romanian deadlifts, ice skaters, resistance band shuffling. And there are a variety of other things. You can look up leg exercises, lower body exercises online, and you want to do these things at a very high repetitions, not necessarily high weight, but you want your body to take those impacts, be undergoing that resistance many times. And then, so there's the leg strengthening. I also think, you know, you want to work on your upper body a bit, but I think that's more from a maintenance standpoint. So more of like a prepare for injury prevention. So working on things like your rotator cuff, doing a bunch of resistance band exercises for your elbow, things like that, rather than, you know, bicep curls and bench pressing. I don't necessarily think strengthening the big muscles of your arm is going to have as much of an impact strictly for racquetball as doing things that will make you ready to take the impact of a racquetball swing on your arm many, many times over the course of a match or a tournament. And then finally, conditioning in the cardiovascular sense and the quick feet sense. So I would work on quick feet a lot, and I would try to get my heart rate up. Those are the two other important things. For quick feet, I'd like to do things like the star drill, and you can look that up, but essentially that is shuffling to the back left, back right, side to side, and then front left, front right, and then back to center between each repetition. And I like to do it with a racket in hand and actually hit a ball at each of those six positions. And that will, you know, actually prepare you to make the movements of a racquetball game. Whereas I think doing things like ladder drills make you better at doing ladder drills, but they don't make you better at actual racquetball movements that you're going to be making a bunch of times. And then cardiovascular-wise, you can kind of pick your poison here, but again, I like to take the overall core concept of try to mimic what cardio your body's going to be undergoing during a racquetball match. So again, short bursts of high intensity energy expenditure followed by rests. I would try to mimic that. And you can try something like high intensity interval training, HIIT, and that's going to help with your ability to mimic what the stressors of a racquetball game put on your body. So those are the things I would try to do to give you some more specifics to look at in those departments. I think with the quick feet, you can do things like quick step ups onto a box. You can just do basically a bunch of side to side shuffles. And again, do this for maybe a period of 30 seconds at most, and then take some rest, and then do it again, take some rest, repeat that. With the cardio training, you can do things like essentially the high intensity interval training would be something like almost go at a sprinting pace for 30 seconds and then, you know, maybe walk for the next 30 seconds. You can do things like, I like to do 100 yard sprints where I'll sprint 100 yards, walk back, sprint 100 yards, walk back. Similar things to that. Find something that will mimic a racquetball game for both quick feet, for cardio, for leg strengthening, and for upper body, and hammer out those exercises. Maybe I'll get a bit more specific with the workout program and exactly what I think would be the best specific workouts. But for now, I think hitting those core concepts of how do I mimic a racquetball game and do something that is as hard or harder than what I'm going to be facing in an actual match. So hope that helps. Again, with any questions, you can reach out to me at dylan@racquetballshow.com, dylan@racquetballshow.com. The Racquetball Show is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, vegetarians, and racquetball players get lower rates on their life insurance. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people. Health IQ can save customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance
for living a health-conscious lifestyle. To see if you qualify, to learn more, or to get a free quote on life insurance, you can visit healthiq.com/TRS. Link in the podcast description. This is a great way of supporting the podcast and of potentially getting great savings on your life insurance. Check them out.
I am here with John Ellis, who is former number three professional player in the world. He had eight pro tour stop wins in his day, along with one doubles pro tour stop. He won the very first racquetball Pan Am Games, and he now is the owner of Professional Racquetball Academy, where he teaches players in Stockton, California, and runs an awesome racquetball program out of Stockton, where I'm sure many people know the 209 Ballers in Stockton. John, thanks so much for coming on and joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, John. Thanks for having me. Sorry about all the technical difficulties earlier.
No problem. Yeah, difficulties on my end too, so no worries. So, John, you know, Stockton is known for having a ton of awesome players. What would you say is the reason for that?
Yeah, it was kind of a lucky situation. You know, there was two main clubs in Stockton when I was growing up, late 70s through the 80s, early 90s. And so the second club, which was called Westland Racquet Club, you know, they got lucky, and the manager, the general manager at the time, Rob Ferens, decided to hire Jody Nance as the racquetball instructor for juniors, a new program that he wanted to establish. I didn't have a junior program coming up. I was around a bunch of adults, and I had one other junior player at my club, a guy named Jeff Russell, who was a great player, won junior nationals as a 12-year-old in Davison, Michigan. But I didn't have, like, a program that I was a part of in Stockton. I had... There was other programs around that I could go to camps, Jerry Price hosting camps in Pleasanton, up in Reading, and other areas that were great for me to attend events like that. But Jody really started a junior program here in, I would say, the mid to late 90s. And, you know, and her, some of her first kids were Ismael Aldana, Jose Rojas, Marky Rojas. And those kids were just... kids of parents that were working out at the club, playing handball, maybe playing a little racquetball too, and it was great. It provided them an environment to grow up and not be hanging around in the wrong parts of town here in Stockton. And be really honest, they all come from rough areas, and that there's some action that goes down in their areas that they grow up in. And so for them to be at the club was really important for them to stay out of some trouble, and Jody was a big inspiration and helped to their first portions of their game. And their goal early on with her was to, be able to attend the junior nationals and feel like you belong there. And they did that pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's awesome. What would you say was the age at which one of them first surpassed you?
So I lost my first match in a tournament to Jose when he was 14.
Yeah.
15 maybe. I had taken him to Japan. I took him and Ismael Aldana to Japan with me to Tokyo for like 8 days, 10 days, something like that. And when they were 14, kind of crazy, you know. And I was just coming off of my first shoulder surgery, and it was really my first tournament playing back and trying to actually win a tournament. Dan Fowler was one of the other pros that was out there, and you know, some of the Japanese players were tough, and a couple of the Korean players came over and they were tough too. And so I was, you know, probably at about 70%, 60% after the surgery and recovery, and said, well, this was 13 months later. So I had a tournament to play, which was fun and to compete in and take those kids with me to experience it. But it helped Jose. Jose was dialed in on me with his eyes the whole time, especially at the club. Like, he was really taking it in. Ismael, not quite as much, you know. So no surprise with Jose, a year later, a half year later, he beat me at a tournament at my home club, and I didn't feel it coming because I was running the tournament, and it was the finals, I didn't realize it was that important to him until I got on the court and felt the intensity and everyone rooting against me and rooting for him, which was kind of that first slap I got at my own club where I was like, okay, you're the old guy now. These guys were rooting for them to beat you now, and it was tough to swallow. But it was okay. He thoroughly beat me that day at 15, so it wasn't even really close. So, you know, it's okay. We played a couple matches, as he turned 17, 18. Then after that, it was, I'm not going to beat him in the tournament play anymore.
Yeah, that's funny. So
Speaking of Jose, what is he up to these days? Why did he part from professional racquetball?
I saw him today, as a matter of fact. Yeah, you'd have to ask him exactly why. You know, my feelings, my beliefs are that it's tough to make a living in racquetball, period, as you would know yourself, you know. It's a nice dream to do and to try to accomplish, just even being able to play a season, let alone a bunch of them in a row like he's been able to do while graduating from University of Pacific. So I think that's partly is just the money involved here and not being able to really get your teeth into making some money for, you know, as he turns 28, 29, whatever he is now. Probably frustrating a little bit to not be able to get more wins and to deal with Kane. Be really honest, it's got, you know, they understand how great Kane is. It's tough to beat him, and Jose's had one moment of success with that and a lot of losses. So there maybe is just a step back to evaluate, see where the tour goes as well as new ownership happens. I think all those things played a part. He also had a job offer from a friend here in town, Knox LaRue. So he's working every day, happy. He's got a fiance now, so he's around her a lot. You know, it's kind of just those times. And he's 20. What is he, 28? So, you know, we all seen him racquetball. All his racquetball diaries have watched him grow up, not just myself here in his hometown, but others as well. And he's a little older now.
Yeah, totally. And I'd love to have him on to discuss, but you know, as much as I like hearing he's happy, I'd love to see him back out on the courts and playing pro stuff.
I agree. I don't think he's done yet to having
okay.
said that.
Good. Good.
A couple seasons somewhere along the line. But having said that, you got to do it pretty soon here. You can't sit on comfort of being home and not traveling for too long. Once that happens for too long, then it's troubles. Getting married is another situation. You want to be around your wife in the first year. Or is she okay with you leaving and you okay with leaving? If you have kids too early or too quickly into a marriage, then I always say that second kid and you're in trouble. You might be done traveling for a living, playing racquetball.
Yeah.
The second one, because when now you got that building the family thing going on. And it's really tough to leave both and the spouse.
Yeah, that's a lot to support financially too.
Sure. And racquetball, as we know, it's a struggle. You got to do some winning if you're going to be a primarily player for your income.
Yeah. You mentioned Kane, Wozlenchuk, and potentially him being a reason for Jose, you know, struggling on the tour. I mean, everybody struggles against Kane, but people don't necessarily realize you are, I believe, the only player to have a winning record against Kane. Is that accurate?
Sure, I think so. I don't know. Maybe there's one or two others out there that we just don't hear about that often, but everyone brings me up in front of that because to be honest with you, Russ Menino, you know, rest in peace, Russ. Russ would bring it up on the telecast a lot, you know, on streaming. So, yeah, you know, I played him. I didn't play him after the age of 23, I believe, or 22 even maybe. So I really, you know, I got the winning record. It's great. And I don't really necessarily want to ever play him again in a tournament. Sure, I'll go ahead and take that with me.
Yeah, that's probably smart.
I feel like Cliff's the number of wins Cliff has on him should be thought of as the most, you know, the most impressive feat against Kane. Because I think Cliff has 6, 7, 8 wins on him or something like that. And beat him in a couple big matches at the U.S. Open. And I personally reffed Cliff beat Kane in about 25 minutes in Denver one year in the quarters. And Cliff was outstanding. Kane was awesome already.
Yeah.
Cliff was outstanding. I'm also Kane's first pro stop win. So that's kind of cool now at this stage. You know, like, it's all right. My only loss to him was the finals. And the match itself, if you've never watched it, is a must-watch match.
Really?
It was one of my craziest matches ever and one of my best losses ever. He won the first game 1, I think the second game 2. I had beaten Cliff the day before in 3 straight drive serving him, so I was ready.
Nice.
And he beat me 1 and 2 the first games, and he was like 22 years old or 23. So it was really, you know, just hard to take that he was this good. And so it kind of slapped me in the face in the middle of the match that, you know, the first time I played him, I beat him easy in Stockton 3 straight. He was way too hyper, round of 16s. And so I hadn't played him since then, and that was maybe a year and a month earlier. So it was really, I watched what he was doing, but man, he was really good on the court to experience that early on for him. But I won this game 3, 13-11. I won game 4, 17-15. I was up 7-4 in game 5 when I let myself think, I'm going to win this. And then I didn't score another point after that. But oh, man. He took it from me. I maybe made one mistake. He took it the rest of it. So,
yeah.
You know, he was hungry to get that first win. And it was a great match. It was fun to be a part of it. We played again that same season in May. That was October of Chicago. We played in May for the third time, final time, and it was reverse. I beat him the first two. It was finals, the last match of the year. I beat him the first two. He grinded it away and got 3-4, and then I outdrove Silverman game 5, and it was great. I hung around for about an hour and a half after the match, right there at Los Cabos in the court. Everyone had been gone for 45 minutes because I couldn't really move. I was so exhausted and, you know, mentally wiped out from a whole season that I thought I'd be playing him a lot more going forward, and I never got to play him again. So you never know, you know, when you're going to be close to done, all of a sudden things change for me physically, and I was pretty much done.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite accomplishment or a favorite maybe event or tournament or match that you had in professional racquetball?
Sure, I had two pro setup IRT wins where I beat Sudsy Cliff, you know, semifinal.
Wow.
Those are the best.
Yeah.
Doesn't get better for me than that. That's it. Those two wins, one was Chicago. No, one was Denver and one was Riverside. And they were vice versa for those two. So semis, finals for either one. So they were so good and tough to beat. That has to be the best thing. You know, the Pan Am gold medal in the first one is great. The memory of that match is great. Otto totally screwed me in game 2. I won 2 straight. His terrible call made me have to play for another 45 minutes and exhausted.
Yeah.
But that was in Buenos Aires, Argentina. No video. You never seen video on it, have you? Ever seen that match?
No.
Well, that match. They put up my matches. My Chris Cole loss over and over again is online. Lost to Joel Bonnet's online, but they don't put my wins online. What's up with that?
Yeah, it's all a conspiracy to make you look bad.
Eyes are screwing me.
Yeah, hopefully we can set the record straight here, you know.
Eyes, I'm calling up Jim Eyes. No, I'm kidding. I don't care. Anyways. But yeah, that's crazy. That match has never really surfaced. I don't even know if anyone filmed it. It was 11-10 tiebreaker.
Oh, man.
For the first Pan Am gold medals with my buddy Michael Bronco. We played 2 straight national singles finals against each other, 1-1. So, yeah, that was a fun time. But, yeah, you know, the pro stop wins are great.
Yeah, that's awesome. What do you think it was that allowed you to be so successful on the pro tour?
Oh, a lifetime of building towards it. I knew at 12 I was going to play pro racquetball. Confidence that this was the right decision 95% of the time. You know, I had about 5% of the time where I, you know, felt like this is just a ridiculous decision, life decision to go down this route and play this rough. I mean, as you know now, the pro matches are very physical. I mean, it's a grind. One match and you could be hurting for the rest of the weekend. And the grind of preparing for that is tough as well. So doing that and then, you know, not having the outcomes and not having the money to back it up really and say, you know, I feel like I'm putting in work that's deserving of making a better living than this. And this is all that it is. And so that's, you know, 5% of the time I thought maybe this was crazy, but for the most part I enjoyed it and wouldn't do anything different.
Yeah. What did your training look like back in the day when you were really working your hardest? Specifically, what did that training look like?
Yeah, inconsistent. For starters, like that's one of when I wasn't going well, generally I wasn't consistently not only putting in work, but having a plan. When I did, I had several trainers in my time that were important to me, guys from Stockton here. So when I was putting in a couple, I'm big on speed work. I'm also big on playing sports. So I grew up playing soccer and basketball and did that in high school. And it was the most, I wouldn't play racquetball for the first 7 months of high school. So I wouldn't pick up the rackets from August until March, in middle of March. When basketball ended, finally I pick it up, have a month or two of really annoyed at my level of play because I was rusty, and then it would click around junior nationals, hopefully. It was the goal growing up. So I believed in playing a lot of sports, so I would still run some hoops and some cross training. I cross trained a lot more than worried about lifting. I'm built so compact and short that, you know, my legs and my core, my legs, my backside, you know, that's my strong point. That's why I got to hit the ball so hard, because the timing of starting at 3 and developing the same mechanics since I was like 7, knowing that they were pretty close to right and just tweaking little things here and there, you know, it just allowed me to add power and velocity into the swing. It's also why I need a shoulder replacement now at this point too, because
yeah,
the Rockets, I grew up in the sport. I'm the perfect timing, you know, in my era. We started with little Rockets, and at 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, they grew to the size they are now, basically. So got lighter, and so you could just swing harder and harder as we were becoming men and growing up men and women. So, you know, you see some people's bodies are breaking down because we overswing, and it's not happening as much anymore with the pros. They've learned how to kind of control that. You see more control play, less diving, more getting balls on your feet.
Mm-hmm.
Speed training being a big part of that, you know, people working on explosive movements while being precise and training for that. A lot of my training for that stuff was done in basketball practice through high school, and just really focusing on guarding people as a point guard, you know, and that rolled over to racquetball, and I still believe in that stuff nowadays. But it's a little different around here. Like, the guys who grew up here that I got to watch grow up as kids, and they didn't play outside sports, really, so... You know, there's some difference in philosophies that happen here, and that's, you know, it's okay. It's good. It's fine.
Yeah. So to get a little more specific, maybe, what would a workout day look like?
Yeah. So that's a good question, man. For starters, like 15, 20 years ago now, so I'm starting to forget this kind of stuff. so ellipticals hadn't been invented.
Yeah.
I would do some jogging and some sprints. So, okay, a typical, you know, get back from a tournament, maybe Monday's a work day, maybe it's a recovery day. If I made the semis, I was probably chilling on Monday just a little bit, travel tired. Tuesday, a morning session with a speed and strength coach, which involved a lot of core strengthening, a lot of speed, fast feet, a lot of, you know, precision cutting so that I'm not taking negative steps, useless steps. From there, it was probably a little food and then into a afternoon HIIT session. I had practice partners around here that, you know, open players. And my dad, at that point, my dad had, I'd say about in my 12 years, I'd say about 75% of it was my dad helping me drill as my coach, 25% of me living in another city, so I'm on my own, maybe working, maybe putting work in, maybe fooling around a little bit too. So, you know, I would have nights where I'd run some hoops too. I did have massage going and a little bit of physical therapy, so I was attentive to that stuff. The one thing I didn't do really well is I didn't stretch. I didn't add stretching to my routine, yoga and stuff like that that I might do now. A lot of plyometric work, a lot of speed work, and a lot of exhausting, grueling workouts, you know, little sprint workouts, but not so much track sprint stuff. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Racquetball. Plenty of racquetball, you know. And I lived in SoCal. I was playing squash all the time. You know, a little bit outdoor racquetball. When I lived in Ohio, I was playing tennis sometimes. Just really... really cross training with other sports, along with some speed and core work. Not a ton of lifting.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
What?
Probably should have done more maintenance lifting for my arm. Really, thinking, looking back at it now.
Gotcha. What advice would you give to a beginning or intermediate player, if you could just give them one really good nugget?
Like a club player, somebody interested in a tournament and possibly playing a tournament, or just at their club. Just wants to beat their friends at their club.
Hmm.
Which one? Because they're different.
Yeah. Well, why not both in that case?
Well, yeah. I mean, the friends at the club one, you know, it's how can you, you know, focus on learning some new serves that your buddies don't see you hitting and practice that stuff away from them a little bit. Control a ceiling ball on your own. Go to another court every now and then and literally hit ceiling balls to yourself that don't come off the back wall. If you can't return one because it's so good, and it's not coming off the back wall, that's, hey, success. Those would be the two main things for club play, is learn how to serve more serves than your three serves you have, and learn how to hit a ceiling ball that doesn't come way flying off the back wall or hits the sidewall early and comes to the middle and being a setup every time. The player that's going to, you know, the CB player that wants to play tournaments and loves the sport, and you can see that it grabs them, they're going to be a diehard. You know, that would be start to get on YouTube now and take advantage of everything you got there. Watch a bunch of the tutorials. Watch match play. don't just watch the ball, watch their feet. You know, really work on different serves. Get lessons from somebody qualified that you trust, and you know, hear a lot of voices, but don't take stock into all of them, because everyone's got a voice in racquetball. Everyone wants to tell you something about your game until they know they can't tell you something about your game.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that kind of, you know, you have to, I would say, just because you're a C or B player right now, it's an easy sport to get to the A level. To become an elite player and an open player, that takes some work, and if that's what you desire to do, then you gotta invest some time into it. The club player, don't invest much more time than you do. Just put another 10, 15 minutes of a couple of little things here. Work on a couple serves, hit a couple student balls. You don't have enough time to be good. You don't care enough. Want to beat your buddies. Play league, you know.
Yeah, hey, fair point. Nothing wrong with that.
Right. As a matter of fact, that's an important part of the game. We all look at it from our side, which is the diehard side, the tournament side, travel around the country side. There's a lot of players who could give a shit about that side and just want to work out and sweat. And so that part is the part that, you know, there's no attention to them anymore, because there's no conversation happening outside of their one or two friends that don't wear eye guards and they're making a mistake and they don't wear the tether thing around their wrist, or they're wearing crappy shoes that are marking up the court. So there's no police in that right now, because unfortunately clubs just don't have that racquetball person in their club during the peak hours, or even off hours, when you can maybe bring some non-racquetball playing members to the court and just give them 20 minutes of an introduction for free.
Totally. So yeah. You've had a lot of success running programs in Stockton. I know you run shootouts, which are a model that a lot of people are trying to essentially mimic in their own areas. What are the biggest things you've been able to implement, and how have you done that?
Well, the tournaments, luckily here with the company InShape, they have a whole bunch of clubs. They're at 90-some clubs, I believe, now. And within our area, you know, we have, God, I guess, you know, 12 to 15 clubs that have racquetball that are at least three courts, which is then doable for what the tournament style that we call shootout style, which is one division playing basically at one time, especially on 3- and 4-court facilities. If you got up to 6 courts, maybe you can sneak 2 divisions in. We have 9 courts at our home InShape club, so we can have 2 divisions going at once. But essentially, it plays until the division ends, and it's a pool play style, round robin style, into a playoff format based on wins. Whether your match wins are 2 out of 3 to 11, tiebreaker to 5, or 1 game to 15, sometimes 1 game to 11 if we go with something crazy like one pool of 12, and you're gonna have 11 games to 11 up front before we go into a playoff of 4. Also, if somebody backs out at the last second, nobody wants to pay for a tournament in advance anymore. They want to pay a check-in. And I don't blame them, you know what I mean? It's a lot to ask of people to pay in advance for a non-national or U.S. Open-style event, pro-style event. They just don't trust it. And so, you know, if you can handle playing a check-in, well, this style handles that person that drops out or no-shows on you. You're not happy about that by any means, but it doesn't kill the tournament because they get so much round-robin play before they even get there. Some players get tired of too much of it. Like, come on, man, you didn't have to do this to us. You could have gave us one or two less games into the playoffs. And I just say, hey, you know, you get a lot of value out of this style here, and you don't lose the whole weekend unless you want to play 2 divisions, which those that do play 2 divisions in 1 weekend are crazy, but there's plenty of them out there that can handle one each day. I can't. My arm's toasted after one division, playing something like anywhere from 8 games to, at the high end, maybe 15 games to 11, somewhere in there or something like that, or a combination of games of 15 and 11. The prize matters to me. I brought back the prize. I have kind of eliminated the prize money aspect, so guys like yourself and all the dudes around here, you know, would love to see more of that, but prize money just means I'm going to lose money, and I'm not going to be doing this if I'm losing money, so something's got to give. So my opinion on that was bring back cool prizes, and it doesn't have to just be trophies. Put some time and money into that, not as much as you would put in prize money, of course, but make it cool, make it something that they can win, and we don't give anything for second, man. Get a good handshake, talk you up a little bit, you know, take some photos, you're on there, you're on the internet for racquetball, but you gotta win to get a champion's award here, and if you make them cool, then you'll want to display it at work or home, and that's what I want. I want something that looks great in a photo where other people are going, that's pretty cool to win. That's worth it. Give me my money to try to win that one right there, as long as you feed me a little as well.
If you ain't first, you're last.
Right, so that's kind of it is here. But it hurts to take that photo when you take second and put in the same amount of work, yeah, but lose.
Totally.
You know, hey,
it's a motivation.
At that point, you're happy it's over, motivation. With, to be honest with you.
what are the prizes?
Yeah, you know, so the Super Bowl shootout is the day before the Super Bowl. And of course, not on Super Bowl, but that's a really nice, heavy replica Lombardi trophy.
Nice.
Very cool. This last one was tough. I changed the name and went to Pot of Gold shootout because it's on St. Patty's Day. And it's, nothing was really ringing. So I got one of, and this is totally not Irish, it's German, but I got one of the boots, like the Das Boots, big glass 2-liter filled, really nice thick glass boot, and then had it done up really nicely, and put, you know, and they dug it, they like it. The the next one's in Turlock, it's called Titans of Turlock, and it's basically a replica gladiator mask from the movie, and pretty nice one, you know, it's gonna come all oily and stuff. I'm gonna have to clean it up, shine it up, and then I'll take it in to Things Remembered and get it worked on, and they'll charge me way too much, and that's okay though. And, you know, it'll be a nice prize that people will be like, I'm going to display this at home. I'm going to be proud that I won this. It's not going to be a trophy that I'm not going to care about in about 6 months.
Yeah.
It's going to be something I want to have around for a while.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love the non-traditional aspect to the way you do things, because I, the way I see it, a lot of the tournaments are done in a very similar way. You know, you get a T-shirt as a souvenir, and everyone gets just the same medal at every tournament. And people aren't as thrilled by it as they would be for something unique and exciting like that.
Sure, I mean, that's the one thing about the sport of pickleball, which, you know, there's a lot of racquetballers playing pickleball as well, but, you know, they have, I mean, every photo from every tournament looks the same. They put their pickleball paddle up, and they have the dorky little medal right there. That's, so what? You know, like, that's not that cool. Good win, but that's not that cool. Like, I want something that's, like, has some character to it, something you want to display at work. Something that you know that looks like it's, hey, that's cool. You would have bought that to display it at your house because it looks good. There's a couple. I mean, there's others that I could go into that, but you know, they try to put a little effort into the theme around the award. Try to have some food at the event still. Nothing as crazy as we used to do when there's 200, 250 players and much more money involved, to be honest. Clubs don't have the space to let you have hospitality like that anymore. They don't really want food smelling going on at the club where people are working out. Like I said, InShape doesn't allow alcohol because it's, you know, they're promoting an InShape lifestyle, which isn't drinking alcohol. So, you know, there's no alcohol in the club. Of course, I'm not checking everyone's water bottle that has a look, but I can't police everything. But you know, for the most part, you know, we abide by all that and try to make sure that people understand that it's just the way it has to be nowadays for us to have tournaments still. So. And I enjoy them. It's fun. It's fun to see players come in and out kind of quicker than they used to. And it's like different tournaments for different people that over the same weekend where I'm there the whole time, so I see it all. So it's fun.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to somebody who's trying to set up a similarly awesome program in their own area?
Yeah, well, first thing I would say is, you know, plan on sanctioning with USA Racquetball. I'm pretty pro USA Racquetball. You know, I know they've been understaffed and challenged over the years, for sure, and it's been a long time of being associated with AARA and USAR now. So I would say sanction the event first and utilize the tools that R2 provides, that they work together. Ryan did a great thing with that program, and I'm sure there's other people out there that try, you know, that want to do something similar to what he's done and what he's association is with USA Racquetball, but what he did was great. It's I was one of his test dummies early on, up in the middle of the night calling him because it wasn't working early on, and so it's been a lot of years of it working really well. And so I think that tool of using the website to run a tournament is invaluable and the reason why you would want to sanction right off the bat. But you know, don't try to, you know, for us again, if you're going to go shoot outside, don't try to have too many divisions. Make it successful with the divisions that you have. Be able to finish by 8 o'clock at night. Like, done. You're definitely done. And sometimes, you know, depending on the number of courts, you know, that's going to lead to maybe two division stops for the day. Maybe you can squeeze in three if you have six courts. What else? You know, you're a lot of value. Different opponents is great. It can be too much, but don't go too little on them. Get them ready. Keep communicating throughout the event once you get into it that you're going to be on court. You want people not to have to warm up every single time. That's what kills tournaments sometimes, is people spend 20 minutes warming up, and the ref does. Nobody knows how to ref anymore. Well, not in California, at least.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to ref. Nobody knows how to ref, and they don't know how to get people going, you know, and be a little tough on that. Like, hey, 5 minutes is 5 minutes. It's not enough time anyways. You know that anyways. You got to be preparing before. You're always asking the desk, what time is this? Shootout style allows you to come off the court and be annoyed that you're going back on the court. But cool with it because you're not going to get cold and, you know you're running back on the court. You don't have to sit around and wait for when's my next match, how long before I warm up, what am I doing, how am I eating. You're into it. You're diving in for 5 hours of racquetball, 4 hours to 7 hours. It generally ends up being about 5 hours of racquetball. You're going to be tired at the end whether you win or lose. The tough part is there's no ref. So if there's two people or two teams that can't handle each other on the court, then they got to come to the desk, and I've either got to have help, which I usually do with a girl named Jasmine Trevino here and a couple others, and I'll go ref it, or I need people to help me out and ref a match, which, again, they don't want to ref these days. It's crazy. Also, the number of courts can dictate how many teams you can have in it or players. For example, if it's a three-court facility and I'm going to go from eight to eight, I'm only going to have two divisions and only 12 teams per division. And if you get all 12 and you sell out, then you're going to have two pools of six. And I'm going to have a semis because I don't even think there's enough time to have a feeder round into the semis and take three teams from each pool. Does that make sense? So, you know, you have to limit the amount of teams. And if you limit it and market it right, then you'll get people to sign up earlier because they don't want to miss out, especially the fun locations. The terms have gotten a little bit fun and a little social for us because we have the local area will maybe have a little party that they put together because they're just happy that PL players are from out of town or coming to their area. They want their tournament to be memorable. So that's kind of something that's been happening over the last couple of years that's a little new, and it's a good time. Makes me want to stick around in town and not drive back and forth, you know, even when it's only in, say it's only an hour drive, not either way, no big deal. I'll just stay in town and have a good time with all of these people, and it kind of, for me personally, it bridges that gap of not traveling nationally anymore. Mm. And going to national doubles or national singles. I haven't been to the U.S. Open for 10 years.
Wow.
I haven't been to the U.S. Open in Minnesota.
Yeah.
So, and I'm, you know, it's not, I don't really miss it that much because I'm around tournament players all the time. I just, you know, I don't see some people that I've known for a long time on a national level anymore, but it's not that cheap either, you know, when you're not getting it paid for anymore.
Yeah, totally.
So am I going on vacation here? Am I on a racquetball? I'm not playing. I'm not playing the pros. I'm not looking. I didn't win that tournament. I'm not looking to win it now. So what the hell do I want to be there for? Well, you know, I know it's fun, but it costs $1,500 to go have fun. And so, you know, that doesn't really, that's, my wife looks at me and goes, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are we doing that for? You're not playing anymore. You're not looking to win it. And I'm, you know, so that's the way it is now. And that's okay. These other tournaments bridge that gap for me.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
So what are your ideas for how to grow the sport in general? If you could implement anything in order to help grow racquetball, what would you implement?
So that's my number one thing right now in my life, besides the tournament play and all that stuff, is junior production here in Northern California that can then be replicated nationwide, worldwide for that matter. They don't have as much problems with that in Mexico and Bolivia, of course. Costa Rica is a nice country. Guatemala's picked up. You know, Central and South America are doing pretty well. The United States and Canada are hurting for it. And like I said earlier, it's the situation where there's no club pros, so you got to resort to, you know, it's going to revolve around volunteerism from adults that are going to say, we're going to start junior programs. We're going to get kids on the court. We're going to ask the club to block out time at least one night a week, and we're going to have as many people as you need to run a successful program, which is, however many courts you're going to have, you're going to need one instructor on that court, minimum. And then you should have one or two people outside of the court who are kind of handling, you know, sign-ins, coming in, who needs rackets, who needs eye guards. Can't expect kids to have rackets and eye guards right off the bat. Families aren't buying that stuff right now. You need to let them loan that to them for several times before they're ready to commit to the sport. And that might coincide with committing to a membership at that local club, which is what you want to feed that club is, hey, we're going to bring new members in because we're going to get outside kids to have their parents bring them in and play racquetball and see how happy they'll be being a part of this class, whether there's three courts or nine courts. We use eight of the nine courts for our Monday night class. We have eight volunteer instructors pretty much every time. Sometimes we'll be a little light if some of the guys are on the road. some of our older juniors, like an Antonio Rojas, who's 15, my son Julius, who's 15, Jesse Rojas, who's 17, Ricky Diaz, 17. Those are part of our instruction staff on Monday. They don't need that class anymore. They're pretty good already. They have a Thursday night class for the more advanced. We have a bunch of volunteers. My mom's outside with the rackets and agars for rental or loaner, and she's taking everyone's name who's there that week, contact information, parents, having them sign a, and this is a big one that's going around right now, having them sign a waiver that gives us, you know, ability to take photos of them. If they don't want to be a part of that, then their kid better know that they're not get out of that photo, because that stuff's kind of important nowadays too. If you say racquetball's instructors program revolves around that liability type of stuff, as well as the instructional portion of it. So, you know, we have a game plan. I set the lesson plan every Monday morning for what our class is going to be about. We call it Fitness Forever Junior Racquetball Class. We've taken this program on the road to, I guess we're at another 8 clubs out of those 8 in 2017 and 18 we've been working on. Out of those 8, I'd say 4 of them have kind of made it work. The other 4 have dropped off and it's failed. And it's only failed because it's tough to get people to volunteer time. They have real jobs and lives to deal with and are tired at, and the consistency is tough to get the kids there if you're not really amped. Our program's successful because kids come in with their parents to go to kids club nowadays, and they see it and go, what is that? There's 40 kids over there. But it's right there. Let's go look at it. And then next thing you know, they're in too. Not all of them stick around because they don't always like it. But you know, a lot of them do, and some of them leave the next year and you don't know why. Well, maybe their parents aren't working out at that time anymore. I don't want to say we're a babysitting service or anything like that, because we're generally trying to introduce them with a game plan. Some kids are tough, man. Some kids, you know, they're tired from a long day of school, and maybe they're acting up in school anyways, and now they're acting up here. And so that's, you know, you gotta be patient. You gotta want to be there. You know, if it's a pain in the ass for yourself to go down and be an instructor on those nights, then it's going to be tough for you to have any consistency. But it revolves around volunteerism, and the clubs have to allow that to happen. And it's another reason to get certified with USA Racquetball or AmPro. So I'm certified with both. You know, like I play no favors on the international portion or the USA. I'm just certified with both to make it easy. And so, you know, carry the insurance that comes with that, and that allows the club to feel pretty good about it. But I won't lie, there's some of our instructors that aren't certified, and I'm hoping that nobody cracks anybody with a racket and all that, but we'll deal with that problem if that happens, because we're introducing racquetball to a bunch of kids, and it can be replicated. It's just gonna have to revolve around people wanting to give up some of their time per week, couple hours per week. And if they're thinking about it correctly, it's not just because they care about kids playing the sport. They can get selfish and start to say, if we do this, we have a better chance of saving our own courts. Because if you don't, and they're empty too often, and there's no programming, it's just looking dead, well, you'll watch more courts turn into something else. And it's possible here, man. This racquetball can go away. It's crazy. That space is too valuable. It can go away on a scale that's a little too big for the sport to survive. You know, there could be courts here, one-offs here and there, but you know, it could go away.
Yeah.
So we're trying to keep that from happening. My dad's really into that part of it, too. I mean, he calls it, you know, Save Our Courts, SOC. You know, it's a big picture. You know, it's a little corny, but it's fine. It's cute, too.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, I really appreciate everything you're doing for the sport, and it's I think, super helpful, especially starting with the juniors. And I'll just say, for anyone out there who's, you know, trying to help out juniors in their area, I would say, you know, reach out to John or reach out to USA Racquetball or Wendell Pelham in Portland. He's a great resource for, they collect donated rackets and they're able to send them to juniors who might be in a less fortunate situation to be able to afford those things. So there are a lot of resources out there if you are looking to grow programs, especially for juniors throughout the nation or wherever. Reach out to these folks.
Yeah, especially as players who've been in the game for a long time get to a stage where they can retire. You know, it's a good way to get connected to the kids too, and be 50s, 60s, and still, you know, have a relationship with some kids that you're helping on the court. and you know, kind of just give you that good feeling. Or, you know, and you know, as I'm 45 now, it's, you know, it's, I start to understand, you start to understand that as you get to your middle ages, you start to understand that feeling that that's coming. That's coming down the line here. I'm going to be in my 50s and 60s, and my kids are going to be a grandparent in a short amount of time. I've been retired from racquetball essentially for 12 to 15 years already, whatever it is. So, you know, it all happens pretty quick. And those are the ones who really maybe could be the ones that really say, okay, we're gonna get involved and do what we can in our area. So I'd welcome anybody who wants to email or call me about it. I'm sure USA Racquetball, like you just said. I think there's some connection with our Fitness Forever program that'll happen with USA Racquetball, and you'll see maybe a little more on that. It's powered by Reaching Your Dream Foundation, for sure. Mike Lippitt and the board here has done a lot, you know, for the sport, not only in our area, but obviously when it comes to the pro game and the young pros coming up. So their involvement with that's great, but I feel like this is really the heart of what they're trying to accomplish, is what we're doing with the Fitness Forever program. So we got good support there. You need a little bit of financial support, but for the most part, it's pretty volunteer-based, and you know, we believe in make this free for the kids. If we can do this and sustain the number of courts and maybe even get some courts put in, more courts built, and more juniors playing in the United States, you know, maybe there will be a situation where you can charge in your area for a program. There's no reason not to. They do in Mexico, I guarantee it. There's people, there's coaches making a living teaching hundreds of junior racquetball players in Chihuahua, San Luis Potosí, Guadalajara, I'm sure now, Monterrey, a couple other cities, all great racquetball cities with multiple clubs with hundreds of kids playing racquetball. There's a reason why we're seeing this explosion of great players from both the female and male side in Mexico. So it's possible in the future, but, you know, grassroots to the fullest right now. It's pretty funny. Some Monday nights are. I had 9 kids on my court the other night that were 5 through 11 and all pretty much beginners, and 3 of them were nuts. And 3 of them had to go sit next to my mom for a little while halfway through because that was it. You know, and that was no getting overly frustrated, but it's just, you're out. You gotta go. You can't keep doing that. You know, you can't keep not listening at all because these other kids are really into it and they want to learn something here real quick and hit the ball as often as possible too. That's a part of it as well. I'm talking a lot about this, but having the game plan so that they're not bored sitting on the side wall listening to you talk the whole time, or shadow swinging and holding the grip the whole time. Really don't care about teaching players to be great racquetball players in their first, second, even 20th session. If they want to, they'll seek it out on their own, and you'll see them practicing and hitting around, and they'll maybe come talk to you about a lesson or just seek out info. You can tell, but there's a bunch of them that are a little wild, just want to swing and hit the ball and want to be active. And so you get them trying to learn how to maybe do a drill, even if they swing a little crazy. Maybe hold the racket a little bit right, but don't worry too much. Hit the ball hard, you know. Hit the ball at that front wall first. Understand why you're skipping the ball a little bit. But let's keep it active. Keep it active so that they're not sitting on the wall listening to a voice the whole time.
Yep, totally. Yeah, I think make it fun for kids is the number one thing to get them going. So, John, do you have a favorite racquetball story throughout all your years? Maybe something that's especially funny or especially like a happy moment for you? Just a favorite racquetball story of yours?
I mean, so junior nationals were funny because maybe there was Indianapolis, there was, you know, you'd wake up and there'd be something funky happening at the hotel that would involve Sudsy. He was quite a character, and for me, being a guy who was more, I was more quiet, a little shy, focused on winning, and not really there to make great buddies. Had a lot of California friends because we had a big crew back then, but Sudsy cracked me up a lot. You know, Indianapolis, woke up one morning and looked out the window, and there was the giant fountain at the hotel was filled with Suds. So everyone, he did it, right? You know, all these rumors, there's always someone else. You know, he would always blame someone else. Said they're just like, I think when he was 8 and I was 10, I think he super glued himself into his hotel room accidentally for a day. Like they were stuck. They literally super glued the door and they were stuck in there. So there's all kinds of funny junior stuff that would happen along the way that would involve him and Jason. Funny stories. I mean, nothing that I can really tell you about, really. You know, here's something that this kind of leads to this for me. I'm sure guys on the road now are bonding outside of the club and having some good times, especially the single ones and going out a little bit and everything. But there was a lot of close competitors, like close friends that were competitors before my era with Cliff's era, before then with the old school players, I'm sure too. But then, you know, Cliff's era in rolling into the era that I was in, you know, there's a lot of good times on the road outside of the clubs, and that were very radical stuff. Like, you know, guys, some of the guys could party pretty hard and be okay. And then be competing really hard the next event, you know, or that same event, you know, not partying while you're winning. Of course, it came after you were done and all that stuff. But it just always shocked me, like, the bond that you can have in socially and then yet competing at and hating each other for a little while on the court and then rooming with people that you're hating. I got to go play Cliff. I'm rooming with him right now. It's just that whole thing was strange, but yet it was very powerful off the court. You know, those guys were willing to scrap for each other a little bit who lived in different cities, you know, if something happened. And I don't know if that's going on anymore. There's different cultures, different countries involved now, where before it was just, for the most part, just Canadians and United States players. So it's a little different. You know, a lot of the stories I can't really tell.
Well, of course. Sure. Yeah. I appreciate you getting into that, at least that level of detail.
Here's my dumbest moment in racquetball. I was playing the semifinals of the Pan Am Championships, which are going on right now in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Great city, great racquetball city. I'm playing Simon Waugh from Canada. I'm going to school with him at the time, too, so we know each other pretty well. He's literally dealing with the stomach problem real bad. I mean, he's diarrhea, throwing up, the works. He's up on a table. I mean, I'm watching him. I got to play him here. Come up, and I think he's not going to be able to play. we get on the court. He somehow gets out there. He beats the crap out of me the first game. I pretty much own him at school. Kicks my ass the first game. I'm really pissed. I come off the court. I swing my hand, and I think I'm hitting the wall. I hit a glass. I hit a window, and it shatters in front of about 500 people and comes straight down, the loudest noise. People screaming like crazy, like,
oh, man.
I walk in, I'm cut up on the hand. I knew, you know, Winterton's in my ear. Like, I got to kick you out right away. You got to forfeit you. Yes, I know. I know. That's embarrassing. I just punched a window out after my first game loss. It wasn't even the match. So I got forfeited in Bolivia in the semis of this tournament that's going on right now in 94. And so that was embarrassing. I had to give a speech. I wanted to say sorry to the enormous crowd for looking like a bad American busting windows. And funny enough, it was my buddy Pablo Farhey at that time who translated the speech for me. That dude didn't know much English at that time, so that's kind of funny that he was my translator. So yeah, he translated it for me. So Pablo and I go way back to the early mid-90s.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah, just great.
well, yeah. Funny, great.
No, it's great. Huh? It was funny. It's funny now. It was funny that night, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Later that night.
Awesome. Yeah, well, John, I want to be respectful of your time and let you get back to your family and everything, but thanks so much for joining me. This is an awesome conversation. I really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, no problem, Dylan. Good luck with this podcast. You're doing great, man. Keep it up. Entertaining. Get Jose and some of the other guys from Stockton here in the future. I'm sure they'll be fun conversations as well.
Totally. Yeah, thanks, John.
Yeah, say hi to your family, man. Thanks, buddy.
Will do.